there's a wealth of players that are these NWSL newcomers, new signings to the American League, that would not be quote-unquote considered rookies. I think the NWSL should be talking about that nonstop, should be specifically probably talking about the talent that they are attracting from Africa and from South America, and I think they should make an award for this. So this is my official pitch for the NWSL, in addition to the Rookie of the Year award, because I think that the college players also deserve their own shine. I'm going to put my pitch for a Newcomer of the Year award, because I think MVP versus rookie doesn't always tell the whole story. So that's my pitch for that. And I think Kansas City is a really good example of why that's necessary. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of The Late Sub. We are in the thick of it with the NWSL. We are prepping for WNBA training camp. It's time to go long on some of these leagues because we're getting into a groove, and that is very exciting. I love the summertime. It's women's sports utopia ahead. Let's talk about NWSL. Let's talk a little bit about WNBA. Let's dig in. All right, this week it is a perfect time to do a deep dive on the NWSL. Can't believe we haven't really done that in a little bit. There's been a lot of basketball to talk about, but we are now 5 games into the NWSL season. That's almost a fifth of this year's regular season. Time is flying. I like this as a check-in point. 5 games in. We've already had an international break in there. We've seen teams have some time to train, some time to move players in, move players out, figure out their style of play. And I also think that this was just a particularly good weekend to reflect that. I think this early in the season, you're still seeing some wobbly performances that will tighten up later in the year. This is a point in time in the NWSL, in my experience, where you're going to see a lot of goals scored while defenses are figuring out their communication and chemistry. It makes it very exciting for the beginning of the season. I do think over time, as fitness becomes a factor and we're seeing some of these defensive infrastructures being built, the goals will go down a little bit. We saw that actually hit like a really steep point around the World Cup break last year. So I'm excited. This is a very exciting time to be watching the NWSL, to be analyzing the NWSL, because we're seeing both the positives kind of what these teams attack can do, while also seeing the weaknesses sometimes in the defense, because we got a lot of goals this week. So big picture, let's kind of look at the weekend. Bird's eye view. Kansas City, top of the league, still yet to lose a game. They've actually only dropped one result so far, which is pretty wild, and they've yet to drop one at home. Score a lot of goals again. 5-2 win over Bay FC this week. We saw Louisville and Orlando, who are also both unbeaten, both got wins this week. Really impressive wins from both teams. Portland, hey, Portland bounced back. They got a big win over Houston, who is still struggling. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Washington and Chicago got big wins over Gotham and Seattle, respectively. Some really interesting things happening for both of these teams. Washington in kind of a lot, well, actually both of them in a way in a rebuild, but we're also seeing Washington and Chicago see dividends right away. And then we also saw Angel City get a very big result against North Carolina, who's a team that, like I've said, I think is very good, after a tumultuous week with some players moving out. So before we get into the games, before we get into analyzing some of these teams that I think did quite well this week, let's talk about sort of setting the stage, what happened throughout this week, because the trade deadline, or perhaps the best way to put it, is the trade window closed last Friday. It's Monday, April 22nd, as we're recording this, at midnight, which means that no trades inside the NWSL can be done from now until August. Now, this is a long trade freeze. It's due to the Olympics, primarily. Sometimes you see the trade window open back up in June, sometimes July, this time not until August. So these teams are pretty locked in terms of activity in between teams in the league. We had mentioned last week that Maria Sanchez had reportedly requested a trade out of the Dash. That was confirmed by her herself. And that trade did actually go through. They did a trade with San Diego. So Maria Sanchez is on the way to San Diego for a lot of money, actually, $500,000 in both allocation money and interleague transfer fees. Houston sent Emily Alvarado to Portland, and they also received Paige Nielsen from Angel City. Angel City did not just move out Nielsen. They also sent Amandine Henri to Utah. And we also saw Gotham do a big goalkeeper signing. They signed Anne-Katrine Berger from Chelsea. So I actually want to talk about Angel City first here, briefly, I think. These moves were interesting to me. Angel City is a team that kind of had a slow start. Like I said, they get a big win. This is sort of retroactive to the big win this weekend. They are under a new coach, which I think is underrated. Of course, Becky Tweed was an interim manager for a number of weeks last season, but this is her first full season as head coach of this team, trying to implement some of her own styles of play, her own vision for the team. Moving Nielsen out, I think, is interesting just in terms of their defensive personnel, though I do think that that's continuing to improve week after week. And obviously, Sarah Gordon is the center point of that, and I feel really comfortable with that. Moving Henri to Utah, I also think is fairly interesting. That was a signing that was meant to kind of assuage the short-term signing of Julie Ertz last year. People might remember that Angel City became the NWSL home for Julie Ertz as she was getting ready for the World Cup. World Cup happens immediately after she retires, so she does not see the season out at Angel City. Angel City brings in more reinforcements. This kind of happens simultaneously to Ertz at the World Cup. They bring in Henri to finish out the season. She goes on loan in the offseason. She comes back. This was a high-profile signing. Now, Henri is very well-known as a French international. She's very well-known as a long-standing player for Lyon. She's won Champions League titles with Lyon. She had a couple very good years in the NWSL a number of years ago. She won the 2017 NWSL title with Portland. But this signing never quite worked, and it did kind of follow this feeling of impact from Angel City, where maybe they were looking for big names because they want to be a big name club, but they were still figuring out how the team worked together. I do think it's possible that this particular movement is, yes, it's moving away from the team that maybe someone like Nielsen, the team that you knew when they were first founded in 2022, are moving away from some of those stopgap movements to try to make the team competitive last year in a player like Henri. But I just liked the way that they played this weekend, and I think that if these moves can set them up well for being competitive in the transfer market in the future, and also it was noted, I think it was Meg Linehan who pointed this out, they might see the return of Kristen Press to the roster in the near future, and they needed to make way for that. I don't think these moves are terrible, and in fact, it's hard to overstate over one game, but you look at someone like Lily Nabet, you look at players who Rocky Rodriguez came into this game. There are players who can keep this midfield down. I think Maggie Doherty Howard has been very good. They have the players that they need to maybe make this work, and I like that they're zoning in on who those players are. So feel good about Angel City. But even if you didn't make a trade this week, even if you weren't, you know, Portland, Houston, Angel City, I do think that that trade window does end an air of uncertainty to everybody. We saw other players kind of comment. I think it was Bethany Balser did a tweet about trades. Just, I do think it sets everyone a little bit on edge, makes everyone a little bit uneasy. I do think that there's a little bit of freedom to have that part of the early part of the season over. And we saw some big attacking performances and some wobbly defensive performances. Huge scorelines this week. We saw Louisville put 5 past Utah. We saw Portland put 4 past Houston. Kansas City put 5 past Bay FC. I do think that, again, these large scorelines are not ones we're going to see for the rest of the season, but I do think that they have showcased maybe how a wobbly week, while you're still kind of getting your legs back underneath you, can impact letting the game get out of hand. So let's talk about who played really well. I do think we have to start with Kansas City. Kansas City, big winners so far of the early NWSL season in general, big winners out of this weekend. They've scored 2 goals in the first 6 minutes of this game. They've scored 16 goals in the first 5 games of the season, which is the most ever in NWSL history. Temwa Chawinga and Bina Zanarato have both been incredible signings for this team's attack. Not only in that they're able to put the ball in the back of the net, but the way they generate turnovers. So let's talk about what Kansas City is doing, because it made me laugh a little bit when I was watching it this weekend. Now, we know the big names in Kansas City, right? We know the Dabinha. We know, again, signings like Chawinga, like Zanarato. The resurgence of Vanessa DiBernardo in that midfield. They're playing really, really well. But another big name for this team is obviously manager Vlatko Andonovski. I was joking to someone. This is reductive, but the joke I was making is it almost feels like Andonovski goes and coaches the U.S. Women's National Team. That team has trouble with other teams hitting them on the high press. Andonovski returns to the NWSL and goes, "You guys won't believe the thing that we had trouble with at the international level. I know what's really going to bug people." And that was his main takeaway from his role as an international manager. I mean, again, it's a joke, but it is kind of funny, or perhaps just ironic, that And Inovsky's U.S. women's national team was so committed to building out of the back and kind of slow, methodical play, whereas his NWSL team is just high press and counter all the time. We're going to cough up goal. You're going to cough up the ball. We're going to shoot it in the back of the net. That is what they do. They do quick transition motion. They trust the speed, not only of physical quickness, but also mental quickness on their front line. You don't generate those turnovers unless you're seeing the field of play in a faster way than everybody else. I just think it's kind of a funny switch. And you have to say also, I guess, to Andonovsky's credit, that he recognized that his team is going to be best served by not putting too much pressure on the back line to build out slowly, which I think is true. They still have some question marks back there, I think, as seen by the two goals that they did concede. Not trying to do any sort of like overly wrought midfield play. It's just very NWSL. It's quick transition. You move the ball quickly. You generate turnovers. You sign the right attackers to make the other team pay for those turnovers. And you win games 5-2. I love it. It's really exciting to see what Kansas City's put together. It's nice to see some of these players who maybe struggled last year play a little bit better. It's interesting to see key impact international signings do so well. I've said this before. I think it's possible that Kansas City does not lose once at home this season. I just do think that that's possible. A quick aside, actually, about that. There are a lot of really exciting players. Like I mentioned Chiwenga and Bia, right? Really exciting players who have just entered the league. This has been a very strong season so far, an off season, for international signings in the NWSL. The NWSL's place in the international transfer market has arguably never been stronger after a couple of years where rightfully players were not sure that this was the right fit for them. Which makes me feel like, I feel like it's past time for the league to kind of have a newcomer of the year award in addition to the rookie of the year award. You know, the rookie of the year award is a very American construction, right? It's meant for, traditionally, a player who has entered a league out of college. So they move from quote-unquote amateur status to professional status. They become a candidate for rookie of the year. There's a very obvious player that we'll talk about in a second who I think is the front runner for that, as traditionally understood. But there are so many players who are, in a sense, NWSL rookies, if not new to professional soccer, that I think also deserve recognition for transferring to the style of play of the league so quickly. I think you can look at Chiwenga, you can look at Bia, Asisa Oshawala, Jiso Yun. There's a wealth of players that are these NWSL newcomers, new signings to the American League, that would not be quote-unquote considered rookies. I think the NWSL should be talking about that nonstop, should be specifically probably talking about the talent that they are attracting from Africa and from South America, and I think they should make an award for this. So this is my official pitch for the NWSL, in addition to the Rookie of the Year award, because I think that the college players also deserve their own shine. I'm going to put my pitch for a Newcomer of the Year award, because I think MVP versus rookie doesn't always tell the whole story. So that's my pitch for that, and I think Kansas City is a really good example of why that's necessary. Other teams I want to highlight out of this weekend. This gets into our Rookie of the Year conversation. Washington, the Washington Spirit, had a big game at Audi Field this weekend, taking on the reigning champions, Gotham. They win that game. I really am interested by the Spirit project. I think I talked about this prior to the season beginning. They took some big swings. You know, they fire their coach. They commit to a coach that can't come into the season until midseason. They're under an interim manager. And so they're doing kind of this roster construction under a manager that they don't have yet, though obviously they have a very big name as their general manager, their head of sporting. I'm not entirely sure exactly what his title is, and Mark Kerkorian. The other big swings, they make all these moves in the front office, right? They send Ashley Sanchez to North Carolina. They send Sam Staub to Chicago. And they go all in on a couple of rookies and sort of a reconfiguration of the defense in the midfield. The signing of Casey Krueger, I think, is also still kind of underrated. It was stark to me in that game against Gotham this weekend just how she shuts down an entire side of the field with her defensive capabilities. It's really working for Washington right now. I still think there are growing pains probably in their future. When you put together a young team, the wall is real. I do think that happens. But at the very beginning, what we're seeing after that first week loss, they're on a 4-game winning streak right now, is it's empowering perhaps Trinity Rodman to play her best soccer right now. And this takes us to the player who I do think is the Rookie of the Year frontrunner right now, which is Croy Bethune. Draft pick very high by the Washington Spirit. They acquire that pick by sending out Staub, I believe. And they're And she's been everything the player that they thought that she could be. She scores a goal in this game. She's scored multiple goals now in the NWSL in her first five games as a professional. And it's really heartening, I guess, as an analyst of the NWSL and the U.S. Women's National Team to see a player like Bethune. So Croy Bethune is a player who became known at USC. And she's been on the U.S. Women's National Team's senior teams radar for a while. If you go back to the provisional list for the CONCACAF World Cup qualifying in 2022, she was on that provisional list. So back when, like, for example, Kate Markgraf or Vlatko Andonovski were the decision makers, Bethune was on the radar officially. Her name was in that list. She had some struggles with injuries later in her college career, and she transfers to Georgia. And so I think Washington made the right call, as seen by the first five games of this season, of not letting Bethune's injury history get in the way of the potential that they saw in this player. And it's completely reshaped the Washington midfield. And she also is just a good shooter, too. She's known as a playmaker. She was a playmaker in college, but she can also really score. Her goal this weekend was really impressive, and it was starkly so in contrast to Trinity Rodman, who was getting in behind the Gotham back line over and over and over again, but couldn't quite put the ball in the back of the net. So you need both, right? You need a good playmaker, and you need a good shooter, and they have both in Bethune, who, like I said, I think is a Rookie of the Year front runner. Now, things aren't exactly perfect for Washington just yet. Like I said, 5 weeks in, they've kind of sidelined Ashley Hatch in an interesting way. She's playing out wide a lot more rather than more as a center forward, a target forward, which, as we know, is mostly what she's known for. Those are her particular strengths. There were actually even moments in this game where Rodman got in behind the Gotham back line and she's trying to find the angle from wide, and she doesn't have that obvious passing option of Hatch. And you think to yourself, oh, it would be great if Hatch was there making that run in behind in the central attack. She wasn't there because that wasn't where she was placed on the field. I think that there are still some tweaks they can make to best optimize the use of Hatch, though she obviously had a very good penalty take later in the game. So there are tweaks that still need to be made, and I like that. Again, I want to see more adjustments. I want to see all the players put in the best place to succeed, or if that isn't in the vision for the team, maybe fully commit to something else. But if you're looking at the big quote-unquote, will this work for the Washington Spirit, I do think you have to kind of say the answer is yes. Bethune and Hal Hirschfeld have been really, really good additions. They have a formational structure that allows for more changes in that defense to work. And I was just really impressed by what I saw by them. Like I said, I think Trinity Rodman is one of those players that knows it's an Olympic year and is playing some of her best soccer. And I think that's very exciting. Also want to shout out Orlando, who had a very good game this weekend. They are a team that's been preparing for Barbara Banda's arrival for a number of weeks, just due to, I think, the visa process. She did not make it into market until after the international break. She did finally see the field off the bench for the Pride this weekend. They get this win over San Diego. Really exciting for them. They are set up. You know, Orlando's a team that I think people have trouble trusting the process with. They're a team that's had a lot of turnover in their coaching staff. They've had a lot of turnover in their rosters. They've made big swings at high profile players, and it hasn't always worked out. They've been on the playoff bubble for a number of years, but they can never quite seal the deal. But I like what they're doing with the long-term growth here with Seb Hines as their manager. I would like to think that they have finally gotten this mix right, genuinely. I think that they have really talented young defenders. I think people were talking about Emily Sams, formerly Emily Madrill. She is, I think, also a dark horse for U.S. consideration in the future. They have this basis of defense that's really working for them. They were missing kind of that central striker for a number of weeks. They were not kind of getting the looks on goal that they were maybe generating. I think Adriana and Banda together are going to put other NWSL teams in hell. And so I am very excited to see where that project is going as well. Again, don't want to overstate one win, but ooh, it feels like they were building to that one and they beat a good team. There are other good performances that I maybe want to contextualize through individuals a little bit more. I want to talk about Sophia Smith and I want to talk about Mallory Swanson. And within that, we're going to talk about Portland and we're going to talk about Chicago. So Portland gets huge, big bounce back win against Houston. Now, Houston still kind of seems like they're in trouble, but Portland, I was kind of laughing again, watching this game. They have this attacking explosion, right? And they really just dominate Houston from beginning to end by the second half of the game. There were moments where Houston maybe looked like they could equalize, but they they kind of showcased the attack that the underlying stats have been pointing to for a while. I think I talked about this last week when we were talking about, is it time to move on from Mike Norris, which they ultimately did decide to do. This was a game under an interim manager. Portland's attack has been fine, like capital F fine. Sophia Smith has been good. She is already having a good year. So this Portland win is really interesting to me because, yes, we saw the attack maybe finally start performing to match their stats, and that's great. It's a, you know, going back to sort of the mean in terms of what we should expect from the Portland attack. I still think there are some team-wide questions for Portland. Still getting that midfield mix right. Still getting that defensive mix right. Those questions weren't necessarily asked by Houston. And like I said, Portland, there were some minutes in this game where it looked like they might kind of have trouble maintaining the intensity before things really got out of hand later in the game. Sophia Smith has been really locked in this season, though, I think is kind of the point that I want to get across. I maybe mentioned this when we were talking about She Believes a couple weeks ago, but asked her briefly after the second She Believes game sort of about her performance and about what it means to be locked in this moment. And she is very clear on the fact that she has to keep over and over and over again auditioning every single game for this Olympic squad for the United States. That's good. Like, I mean this in a positive way. She is committed to showing her best self over and over and over again because she wants to be on that 18-player Olympic squad. We saw that this week. I think that she is someone who, over the course of the season, could definitely be in contention for another MVP award. I thought, similarly, let's talk about Mallory Swanson. This is another team, this is another win, where I go, I still have some questions about this team overall. The Chicago Red Stars, we saw last week how they didn't have Swanson available. They did not win. They do have Swanson available in this game. They do win. It feels too simple, but in some ways, that is kind of how the Red Stars work. She was on a heater in this one. Both goals greatly influenced by Swanson. The first one was she picked up the ball at the top of her own box, dribbled it all the way across the field, dropped it off to Ali Schlegel, get the assist on the opening goal. The second goal she shot herself. It was her goal. She shot it with her left foot. She did the classic Swanson, which is that she dragged the ball across the box, pulled defenders in, found her angle, and sent the ball into the back of the net. That's like her favorite move. But notable that she did it from right to left instead of left to right. If she's moving ambidextrously now, y'all, watch out. I'm really happy for Swanson. I think you never know exactly if a player is going to be able to recreate the exact form they were in when they have a serious injury. I tweeted this, but one of the things that made it so hard to swallow that Swanson injury last year was not just that the U.S. lost a great player and you feel for the player personally, but this was supposed to be the peak of an arc that began back in 2021, where she was left off the Tokyo Olympic roster. She had to work very hard to get to the point where she, as an older player, a more mature player, had different facets to her game to be able to sort of, I think someone, I forget who it was, might have been Kim McCauley, said she was kind of matrixing this game. She could do whatever she wanted in this game. That takes work. That takes preparation. That takes rethinking your role on a team. And for her to lose that due to injury last year, I think was particularly devastating. And as we all know, you never know if a player is going to get that back when they come back from an injury that serious. And so it's not just that Swanson feels like she has her fundamentals back, or she feels like she still has her speed, or she still has her touch on the ball. But the decision-making hasn't gone away. Her calmness on the ball hasn't gone away. The speed is still definitely there. And Seattle really struggled to contain her. She really could do whatever she wanted throughout this game. So I think if you're looking at this in the context of the U.S. Women's National Team, have to feel really, really good about what we're seeing from Sophia Smith and what we are seeing from Mallory Swanson. Now, there is less good news for the United States this week coming out of the NWSL. There were two pretty high-profile injuries. Don't know their severity as of yet. But Alex Morgan and Tierna Davidson both had to leave their respective games with injury. Morgan left the game with a left ankle injury after a bad roll, clearly visible from the broadcast. This was late in the game against Orlando. That one was notable in that they did not have any more subs to give, and she still had to leave the game anyway, so San Diego had to finish the game with 10. Did not look great. Hard to tell, again, with Morgan's ankle injury history, sort of what this means for her. Hopefully it was just a stinger, and you put an ice pack on it, and she'll be all right. Davidson seemed to pretty clearly strain, at the very least, strain her hamstring early in Gotham's loss to Washington. That was sort of a perfect storm in that Rodman kept getting in behind, so Davidson was doing these really fast sprints, these recovery runs. During one of those recovery runs, she pulls up, and she's holding her hamstring. The U.S. can't really afford to lose either of these players. Morgan has been the starter up top centrally for months now, ever since Mia Fischel went down. There were clear plans for Morgan within the U.S. Women's National Team structure this year. Again, hopefully it's not too serious. Davidson has settled into a partnership with Naomi Girma that they've started sort of rebuilding at the Gold Cup. Girma herself has had some thigh issues recently. These are not particularly deep positions for the team. And I'm sure at this moment there are some flashback fears to last year where some key injuries really kind of devastated the United States at the World Cup in ways that we're still sort of processing as we're seeing, again, like a player like Swanson return. And not for nothing, the injuries are being, they're kind of brutal for Gotham too. You know, we kind of hyped up this Gotham super team, and you're starting to get that fear. You maybe we saw it with Kansas City last year. We've seen it at times, I think, with Chicago has had really decent or deep injuries. We've seen they haven't had Rose Lavelle at all, Gotham, yet this season. Lynn Williams only just got her first start of the season this weekend. Davidson might be out for a while. Mitch Purse is out for the season. Kelly O'Hara hasn't been available very much. This just hasn't turned into that big super team process that they were hoping for. And with a player like Lavelle, I do think that Gotham at this point has to start thinking like, okay, if we get this player back to the field, then she might have to leave again for the U.S. and then we don't know what happens. I sense some frustration from Gotham in that respect this week. I think that they didn't feel like they put their best foot forward against Washington. And I think that they feel inhibited or restricted by the ongoing international calendar, which I think this is sort of what we've been talking about with them for a long time, which is just that when you do load up on a lot of U.S. Women's National Team players, sometimes this does happen. And injuries are unfortunate, but I think it was Juan Carlos Amoros who said that they're going to be reviewing their internal processes because it's very difficult to get through a season like this, especially one with as high expectations as Gotham has. A couple quick notes again on teams that are starting to struggle a little bit more. Like I said, all of the positive things that I said about teams that won games this season, this weekend, I want to mention Louisville, Bev Yanez getting her first win with the Racing Louisville. Uchenna Kanu is one of the Golden Boot leaders for the NWSL so far. Another fantastic international signing that was not made this year, but in really, really nice nonetheless. I like what they're building. Louisville, I have always felt, is a team that has underperformed their starting 11 talent level. Would love to see a manager like Yanez push the needle on that, because I think if they can start sniping points from people, they've shown that they can score goals, and now the question is just how do you make sure that you're getting the sturdiness on the other end. So very happy for them as well. I think that Louisville, interesting to kind of see a player like Savannah DeMello sort of fall slightly off of the U.S.'s radar post-World Cup. She's done some training with them, but she hasn't, I think, seen a roster in 2024. She's playing really well. She had a great goal this week. Jalen Howell is another player that is trying to work her way back into the U.S. Women's National Team bubble. Like, Louisville's got some players that can really, really play. But other teams that are struggling a little bit, we got to look at the other side. Going back to my point, I feel so good about these wins for some of these teams. I don't always know how to be harsh on the teams that lost. I don't think you can think that one team played really, really well and then look at the other team and say, well, why didn't you win that game, right? But Seattle and San Diego, I think, are two teams that are interesting to look at right now, considering how successful they were last season. San Diego won the Shield, and Seattle was a finalist in the NWSL Championship. They're underachieving right now. They have some of the same weaknesses as last year. San Diego's midfield looked really disjointed again this week. They have a couple really attacking-minded players. They have a very traditional number six in Danny Colaprico, and it just felt like those players were not on the same page entirely. Made it very, very difficult for them to chase the game. The Rain still have trouble in the attack. They are dealing with some injuries as well. I don't want to discount that, but it looked like once Chicago went up early, they're just not equipped to really respond, and that was a criticism of them last year as well. So where do the goals come from and when? And then what is the mode that you move into when you have to chase a game? Because what we saw from the Rain this week is they bring Ziara King on. She immediately scores a long-range golazo. Like I said, some amazing goals this weekend. But then that was it. That was kind of the plan. Send crosses in, try to reach Bethany Balser. It feels like the Rain are just a little bit stuck. And you don't want to call it a team that needs a rebuild, because they've never been set up for that. So how do you make what's happening, or with the players that you have, work right now? Because this is not a team really structurally set up for a full rebuild. And then Houston and Utah still seem to be having some trouble too. Like I said, Houston had a real emotional roller coaster of the week. They might actually have some more defensive reinforcements coming in. There's been some reporting of a very, very good player coming in out of Brazil. But again, still just seemed like a difficult marriage of roster and infrastructure and formational ideas from their head coach, Fran Alonso. I don't fully understand exactly where Houston is going. I think that them turning the Sanchez situation into not a full net negative is actually relatively impressive from their general office, from their general manager. But I'm just not seeing it on the field. I'm still seeing a lot of confusion. I'm seeing a coach that is still walking into these games a little bit tactically naive about what is necessary to at least, you know, vie for a result in the NWSL. And I think that these things can begin to compound. You've already had one star player ask out. Like I said, pretty remarkable that that job got done. Like I said last week, Sanchez's contract was so big that I wasn't sure that any team had the ability to take her on under the salary cap. The fact that San Diego moved those assets to get her, also just fascinating that Houston was able to get much out of that at all. Thought it was an interesting move for San Diego themselves in that, like I said, I feel like their danger spots are more in the midfield, not so much in the attack. Not that Sanchez isn't a great player. Maybe this allows Jaden Shaw to move in. I don't know. Maybe they have greater plans for what they want to do formationally, but I just thought it was an interesting choice considering that that was not the main point of need that I thought that San Diego had. But they have issues kind of now on and off the field, and it can compound. You have a player that's asked out, you get that done, you bring players in, you're hopeful for kind of a fresh vibe in the locker room, but these players want to win, right? They want to get results. I've seen over and over and over again how a rough start can be difficult to overcome itself. And so, I don't think that the Dash need to be making huge front office changes at this moment. I don't think that would be helpful, but I do think that they are sort of in this danger zone of things beginning to compound emotionally. And then Utah, they've been pretty active in the transfer market too. Like I said, they picked up Henri. They had a new signing out of Liga F, I believe, right as we were recording this. They like to play off ball and they don't really have the personnel for it. And so Utah, I think we always knew, came in with a little bit of a slim roster construction philosophy, hoping that Amy Rodriguez would be able to get the team focused on some of the basic fundamentals of NWSL play, which, like we said, can be off ball tenacity, shore up the back line, move quickly in the counter, and then maybe you can steal some results. But It's too open. It's too wide. It's not all quite working for them. And then Bay FC, I think they also just lost control of that game against Kansas City. Again, you give two goals up in the first 6 minutes, and that's going to be a rough day for you. But they lost Alex Loera to an ACL tear, which is very, I'm sure, you know, frustration for player and club alike. And I don't know exactly how they control games now, because what we saw is that their defense, when a game is that wide, felt deeply under pressure and were not able to bounce back from going down 2-0. So the standings are what they are. You know, it's hard to get too hyped about standings this early in the season. But I think that, you know, I'm going to stick with some of my priors. I think Kansas City's for real. I think if a team can score that much, they're going to be competitive in every game. Maybe they don't have to fix the defense this year. Wouldn't that be exciting? if that kind of a shootout team is able to pull things off and finish top of the table. I think Washington has a lot of positives going for them. I think Chicago will go. They have the fundamental structure to be as sturdy as they possibly can. And then in terms of the attack, they will go as far as Mallory Swanson can take them, which it seems like right now is to the moon. I still think highly of North Carolina. Don't think much of that loss other than I think they came up against a really nice Angel City performance. And then it starts to get sort of interesting in the middle. You know, you kind of look at Orlando, you look at Louisville, you look at these teams that are getting results and are now kind of pivoting those into wins. What's the ceiling for those teams? Those teams are not teams that have featured in the playoffs recently. What can they do to get over that next hump? Is Angel City turning the corner? Does San Diego and Seattle need to be worried? Is Bay FC this sort of intricate, talented attack, or is what we see in defensive transition who they really are? I think there are a lot of really, really interesting questions being asked about these teams as we go into week 6. So let me know in the comments, hit me up on Twitter. Y'all know how to find me. If you guys have any interesting things that you would like to know about the NWSL, I'm all ears, because I think there are a lot of interesting facets to get into with all of these teams. I'm really enjoying this season so far. Lots to dig into as we go forward. Do you want to dive deeper into women's sports news of the week? You can get the latest news delivered straight into your inbox. That's right. You can start your morning off right 5 days a week with the Just Women Sports newsletter, our free daily newsletter that brings you the latest and greatest in women's sports. Whether it's breaking news, exclusive conversations, or just a cool stat that you might be missing, we've got you covered. So never miss a story on women's sports. You can subscribe for free at justwomensports.com/newsletter. That's justwomensports.com/newsletter. And we'll see you in your inbox. So after all the soccer talk, I do want to talk a little bit about basketball, but maybe a little bit more off the court than on the court, as we've been doing through March Madness and through the WNBA draft. I think we've had this really interesting conversation online or even in person since the draft or even since the Final Four about this moment in the WNBA. And are they prepared for it? Are they not prepared for it? Should there be outrage about salaries and facilities? Has there not been enough outrage in the past? What should be the expectations for this rookie class? What should be the support expected for the players that have already been there? I think that we've unlocked a new kind of level of conversation about where the WNBA is, which I think is good because I think the WNBA is poised to have a massive next 5 years. The more expertise shared, I guess, about what that will mean for them, I think is really important and good. The thing that kind of triggered this, I think, not just the draft night, because people were talking, you know, salaries and expectations and resources going after draft night, but Caitlin Clark is in the final processes of renewing with Nike. This was originally reported by Shams of The Athletic. There was some further reporting done by The Wall Street Journal. Big picture, Caitlin Clark had an NIL contract with Nike set to end the moment her college career ended, which, as we know, was the national championship game in 2024. So within the context of that particular contract, I think people thought that Nike did really well by Clark this year, right? They had the t-shirts ready to go. They had the marketing. They had the billboards. They had the digital ads. They had the shoes. Part of that was obviously because they see her as a big asset to the company, but also because they were trying to win her back. She fielded offers from Adidas. She fielded offers from Under Armour. She actually had a greater opportunity to do that after going pro because she wasn't restricted by Iowa's NIL, or not NIL, but just Iowa's contract with Nike. Not that players cannot sign with other apparel brands than their schools, but there are restrictions about like what you can wear, where you can wear it, what kind of promotion you can do while wearing Iowa colors. Like all of those different things go into your ability to negotiate a contract with an apparel company. And this is going to be a big deal. This was what the Wall Street Journal most recently reported, which is that this is probably a $28 million lifetime deal over 8 years. So like $28 million over the lifetime of the contract, which is going to be $3.5 million a year for 8 years. She will also reportedly have her own signature shoe, becoming one of only two active WNBA players signed with Nike with a signature shoe deal. Now, to be clear about what I mean by that, I don't just mean like a branded shoe or a colorway. Specifically by signature shoe, what I'm talking about is a shoe whose entire shape has been created custom with collaboration with a particular athlete. It will now go under their name, and that shoe shape will forever be connected to that athlete. That's what we saw most recently with the Sabrinas. Could have multiple colorways. It could have different design drops. You could see other players actually still use that shape, but it is their shape. It's like what you see with like the Kyries or with Jordans or with, you know, the. I just want to be very specific about that because there are a number of WNBA players who have shoe deals, but they're maybe using a different player's shoe shape. This Clark deal answers some questions, I think, about what it means to be a player of her stature in the WNBA. But I think it also maybe raises some further questions about what kind of a surreal place the W is in right now. There's certainly money to be made as a professional women's basketball player, like real money. For whatever reason, that still seems to be a sticking point for people. You can make a lot of money as a WNBA player. Caitlin Clark is going to make a lot of money. A lot of it does lie in endorsements. I think that there is probably a further conversation to have of this is additional work, right? This is endorsement work from Clark with the Nike shoes, with the State Farm commercials. You know, this is not just for what she's getting paid to play. This is about endorsements, but the endorsement money is very, very real. Her rookie scale begins in the high 70K mark, which is, like, as we know, not very high. It will grow every year for her contract. She also has performance incentives that open her up should her rookie year go well. All-star bonuses, playoff bonuses. She also, in increasingly, it seems like, has a real shot at the Olympic roster, something that probably would have still been out of reach if she had gone back to school. That also opens up endorsement possibilities. Caitlin Clark, Olympian, possibly Olympic gold medal winner, is a different level of endorsement than just, you know, Caitlin Clark, WNBA rookie. Her earning power hasn't diminished at all. And that's an important point to make because I think that's one that people like to argue. Maybe this is a unique player or a unique situation, but I don't think it's going to be. I think we're going to see a number of players already who have made a lot of money in the WNBA continue to do so. And I think we're going to see this new wave of players also continue to make money through the followings that they have also already created. We're also seeing kind of the flip side of it. I want to go to the Chicago Sky for a moment. That, you know, the Sky have already earned hundreds of thousands of new social media followers since drafting Camila Cardoso and Angel Reese. Reese has already pivoted her branding over to Chicago Sky colorways. I think Reebok like immediately sent her a Sky colorway of a shoe for them. I would like to think that Reebok would see the potential of an Angel Reese shoe should hopefully her first couple years in the league go well. We're seeing this reciprocal relationship where all these boats are rising. We're seeing the team's profiles rise. We're seeing the players be able to sort of pivot into this new chapter of their career. That newness, I think, is also exciting for them. They're able to move into new facets of their endorsement careers and their merchandising and all of these different things. I think that's all really positive. I think that when people act like there are no positives to this change for these players from college to pros, they're ignoring all of this stuff. And I think I'm cautious to call it unprecedented because there have been huge megastars of the WNBA in the past. I mean, I know them. You know them. I mean, I think maybe like the biggest one, you know, I'm thinking about like Cheryl Miller or Lisa Leslie or Sue Bird or Diana Taurasi. Like, there have been megastars in the WNBA. This is maybe just the modern version of those players. However, I also don't think it's worth it to ignore some of the things that the WNBA can do better on. Because those things do exist. The growing pains are real. And I think what people have been trying to stress, and I'm going to join the voices of that, is that this moment here, this Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, Camila Cardoso, Cameron Brink moment, is perhaps like exactly 1 year too early, to be frank. The league is going to have some revenue options emerge after this year due to contract end and contract negotiation. What it's going to take for some of these issues to change are going to be TV broadcast money and expansion fee money. And we'll talk about that in a second. But people have discussed some of these different issues for college versus pro, right? So charter flights. Right now, the WNBA does not allow charters other than in the postseason and in back-to-backs. In fact, they have penalized organizations for funding their own charter flights for their players. That is something that has been a huge sore spot for the players versus the owners. Kathy Engelbert has been fairly assertive that it's not possible to fund charter flights as a league consistently year after year. She says, you sign a 4-year contract to do this. Where does the money come from in 4 years to keep going? I think the owners would like to maybe be empowered to do it on their own. I think there's a fear in the parity structure of the league, if you allow these owners to do that, you're going to have these haves and have-nots. My take is that the haves and have-nots already exist, and they should let owners that want to invest in charters do so, because these players are famous. We already had an issue. We already saw an issue with Brittany Griner last year at an airport where they were flying commercial. Someone got in her face because she was notable for reasons outside of just playing in the WNBA. Players like Clark and Reese and Brink and Cardoso are not going to be able to hide on a commercial flight. And I think that there are going to be issues, hopefully not, but even with crowds forming in a terminal, you're going to have people want to talk to these players. You're probably going to have a social media element. You might have people who think it's wise for them to get their phones out, film these players. This is something that the WNBA has to take into account, and they do have to put player safety first. It's not just about what charter flights do for an athlete and the way that they perform. There is about this bigger moment, and they have to have protecting players in the forefront of their minds. Another big issue that we see come up a lot are the facilities. We're seeing some big gains, actually. That is something where they are allowing owners to either invest or not. So we're seeing a team like the Seattle Storm that just opened a $61 million training facility exclusively for the women's team. It's incredible. You're seeing free agents want to go to that program because of that investment. The Aces had already done so. And we already know just how stacked their roster is and how happy their players are to be there. It's not just the athletic support. It's not just the gyms open at all hours so you can shoot. There's the recovery facilities. But it's just the level of professionalism that allows players to feel secure and happy going to work every day. It's having your own locker. It's being treated like the professional that you are. That is something that they're allowing some clubs to invest in if they want to. and some clubs are kind of lagging behind a little bit. I think some teams aligned with NBA teams also have some of those facilities, right? Phoenix, Indiana, New York, I think are good examples of teams that utilize the dual facility structure. But other teams are lagging behind. I mean, Chicago, I mentioned, you know, Reese and Cardoso. These are generally, genuinely famous people. They have a training facility that's in the Chicago suburbs. That contract ends this year, and I think they're hopeful to announce a move soon. But they have to probably legitimately consider security for those players. LA, the LA Sparks, trained at a university last season. These are tricky markets to figure out your own training facilities for a WNBA team, but as the profiles rise, as you sell the tickets, as you capitalize on the fame of some of these players, you have to also be thinking about how you're serving them. And I do think it also just throws into contrast perhaps how players before this group have been underserved. Like I said, I am hopeful that some of these teams will be making announcements for changes soon, but if you want to sell the tickets, if you want to have the sellouts, like I think the Sky are anticipating having with players like Cardoso and Reese on their roster, you have to back it up on the other end. And so they're also stuck in a contract, but hopefully changes soon. So let's talk contracts. The TV deal, the big TV deal for the WNBA is going to be negotiated for next year. That money needs to be significant. We saw the high watermark being the NWSL that they secured. It was around like a $60 million a year investment in their new TV broadcast deal. I think the WNBA, based on the numbers that they're planning on having this year, are going to be looking for a magnitude larger than that. I don't think a $100 million a year contract is out of reach for the WNBA. They're going to be shattering viewership records. We saw the viewership records for just the draft this year. They need to be pushing for hundreds of millions of dollars to flow into the league and these franchises. Expansion is also going to be important to this. Golden State is entering the league next year after paying a fee of $50 million, which frankly I think was a little low. More franchises entering. Part of the expansion argument is not just more rosters, more spots for players, but it's money coming into the league. It's real money coming into the league. After all of that happens, once the money is truly secured, serious money for a serious number of years, there will probably be a push to temporarily open the CBA. That is not uncommon. Make changes that impact revenue share for players, impact salaries to reflect the new realities of revenues for the league, and reflect the new reality in the salary cap. I do think that dub players have felt very restricted by the current CBA that was negotiated at the very beginning of 2020. I understand that. Exponential growth that we've seen over the last couple of years really does deserve a restructuring of terms. Also, obviously, no one could have planned for what actually happened in 2020 after that contract was ratified. And frankly, I think they also, part of this might also mean more games. I think, you know, the WNBA recently expanded to 40 games, which I think is a step in the positive direction. But I do think that at some point you have to talk about season expansion as well. More revenue opportunities for teams, more TV broadcast opportunities for these broadcasters. How do you work the revenues in of actually providing more programming more than kind of being this sort of stuck summer league? I think they need to think about that as well. We're seeing the NWSL season. I know they play fewer games, but week over week, we are seeing an extension of NWSL in the year-round conversation that the WNBA hasn't quite captured. They kind of let college do it for them. And I think that the dub is now in this position to be able to say, well, maybe we don't have to pass this off to the NCAA in the fall. How do we stay in the conversation? How do we keep these revenue structures going? That doesn't just place it on the players to be doing off-season work. Because I think sometimes that is where this lands is, oh, well, the dub continues to be marketed because the players are working in the off-season. How can the WNBA do it themselves? And then this leaves me with kind of the big final philosophical question for the WNBA chasing this season, which is, this is a tipping point. I think there's no question about that. And like I said, maybe 1 year too early, maybe all the gains, you know, you build the viewership, you build the excitement, you sell out these arenas, you make a lot of money this year on those fundamentals that maybe you struggled with in the past, and you cash in next year. There might be some patience necessary. So this is definitely a tipping point. I do think that is true. I'm really excited for what the dub is going to be able to negotiate in the future. But does it have to be a starting point for investment? I think is the question. Nike giving Clark the bag is great. She's a needle mover. She's not only a generational talent, but she is a generational superstar. Right now, she is the North Star that the league is following, and I do not think financially that is necessarily bad. But I'm still kind of stuck by the scarcity model that we're stuck in. Asia Wilson was brought up in the context of this Clark deal, because Asia Wilson does not have a signature shoe with Nike, despite being a Nike athlete. I just don't understand why there's such scarcity for these kinds of deals. We're seeing in other, in men's leagues, there is a pipeline for that kind of success for players. They shouldn't have to be two-time MVPs. They shouldn't have to be two-time champions. They shouldn't have to prove that they can be marketable off the court as well as on. That's a scarcity model. When you start arguing about a player's bona fides for a shoe, it's because it has that is an environment that has been constructed by the factors surrounding these players. And I am hopeful that in the next, like, it doesn't happen immediately, but in the next maybe 5 years, we can start moving away from that scarcity model, because I don't think it serves anybody, to be honest. And I think that's where some of the discourse gets kind of heated, pitting players against each other. I just think more is more. And the Dubs' approach of cautious, meticulous growth needs to be very careful to make sure that they aren't actually holding the floodgates closed when they need them to open. So I do hope that if you're tuning in for, you know, Caitlin Clark, Cameron Brink, Cardoso, Reese, you're going to find players that you really like. And I don't want to put the impetus on the fans to have to push for more change in terms of what we're seeing in marketing and promotion, but I hope that people stick around for the players that are already there. Because to move out of the scarcity model, you have to force sometimes the powers that be that are being overly cautious that there is a market for this stuff. So this has been this week's edition of The Late Sub. Thank you all for hanging out. Again, like I said, if you have any questions about the NWSL season thus far, or even just where the WNBA is going, training camp starts next week, we're all excited. Let us know in the comments. We do read them. We do check them out when we're kind of sculpting what happens each week. I have been your host, Claire Watkins. Shout out to producer extraordinaire Parker Fenton. We will see you next time.